This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Award season caps off with the Oscars this weekend, the creme de la creme for recognizing achievements in film and, of course, fashion.
Tell me about your dress.
I have to ask you.
Who are you wearing?
Who did the dress?
Who are you wearing? We gotta know.
I'm loving this Prada dress.
This dress, a vision in red, a vision in blue.
And that's from a montage put together by Upworthy, demonstrating that despite their dedication, the discipline and craft of Hollywood actresses, their designer dress is what really matters. A few women in Hollywood are showing their disdain for parading like so many thoroughbreds before the big race. And culture reporter for the New York Times, Kara Buckley, wrote in the Times about a revolt building over the red carpet pageantry. Kara, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So among the signs of rebellion, apparently, a few actresses refusing to indulge in the mani cam. First of all, explain the mani cam.
The mani cam is something that E! Entertainment cooked up a couple of years ago. It wasn't enough to just show actresses almost like on a lazy Susan Dias, their 360 glam cam. What they do now is have the actresses, I don't think one actor has ever been asked to do it, to stick their fingers, their hands, into a little box mounted with a camera where they can show off their manicures and whatever jewels they happen to be wearing.
Okay, so who said no to the mani cam?
So, in a revolutionary step, Reese Witherspoon, Jennifer Aniston, and Julianne Moore did not stick their hands into the mani cam at the Screen Actors Guild Award in January.
Well, sacré bleu. I mean, that counts as a revolt?
Well, people don't actually know if they were part of the revolt. What we do know is there has been a steady building in social media around asking women on the red carpet more than, what are you wearing? Did you starve yourself? How much? What are your jewels?
Mm-hmm.
Actually asking them about, you know, what was your role? What was the inspiration for it? What message do you hope to send with it? Which is sort of often the questions that male actors are asked on the red carpet, but less so the women who tend to be treated like beauty pageant mm-hmm. contestants.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that. You point out in your article about this chasm between the celebration of craft that goes on inside and the meat market outside. Here's a clip. This is from the Golden Globe. The hosts, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, they're alluding to what matters in Hollywood. They're talking here of Amal Clooney, wife of the actor George Clooney.
Amal is a human rights lawyer who worked on the Enron case, was an advisor to Kofi Annan regarding Syria, and was selected for a three-person UN commission investigating rules of war violations in the Gaza Strip. So tonight, her husband is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award.
And what everyone was talking about outside and in the days that followed, Amal's white opera gloves. Why is it, Kara, that smart, successful women are fair game in this arena?
Well, you know, there is sort of a blood sport that has originated around red carpet, you know, fashion blogs sort of poking holes at what women look like, what they choose to wear, you know, the best dress, the worst dress. And for some reason, I mean, I guess Kathy Griffin commented that they look like dishwashing gloves. It was off to the races in terms of just the, you know, blog after blog. The Times even wrote an article about all the outrage around her, this international human rights lawyer's gloves that she wore, you know, to the red carpet. So there's this huge chasm, and different organizations, and like I said, social media are beginning to say, this is ridiculous. There's a lot more than what these women are wearing. And it's also, why are we holding them to a totally different standard than we are to the men?
Some of the organizations that you mentioned in your article, hashtag Ask Her More campaign, Amy Poehler's Smart Girls organization.
Right. And also something called the Representation Project, which was started by Joanne, I might be messing her name, Newsom-Seibel, who did an article, or did a, sorry, a documentary called Misrepresentation about Women in Media. And so they originated the Ask Her More campaign. And a couple of, you know, people on the red carpet have started to take up the Ask Her More campaign, and they're eliciting really interesting answers from these women that, you know, are actually insightful as opposed to completely superficial.
Asking questions like what, you know, inspirations?
They're asking questions. I met Julianne Moore at the Critics' Choice Awards in January, was asked, you know, did you have a plan B to acting?
Mm-hmm.
Someone else was asked, what's the best advice you ever received? Things that sort of go more to the person and less, you know, what they look like.
Well, Kari, you find something else at play here, that being a red carpet darling can be one way of closing the gender-based pay gap in Hollywood. What's going on here?
Right. So if a woman, you know, especially an up-and-coming star, does a really good awards season, this is something I didn't know, but, you know, was told to me by someone who tracks fashion and luxury goods and that. Like Lupita Nyong'o was all last year, just showed up in these gorgeous dresses for the awards campaign. She went on to win Best Supporting Actress for 12 Years a Slave and a very lucrative contract with Lancome. Women in Hollywood are paid less than their male counterparts. They're certainly well paid, but they're paid less. You know, we found this out with the results of the Sony hacking. Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams paid less than their male counterparts in American Hustle. So the thought behind this is, sure, they're show ponies, but if they do this well, they're also getting paid. They're landing extra contracts with whatever, you know, ad agency, with whatever luxury goods that may help make up for this pay gap. And the fact that, you know, they might have to retire earlier than their male counterparts, there's, after women hit a certain age, you know, the number of them on screen just drops precipitously, mm-hmm. you know, certainly after the age of 40.
So they're playing the game. But also, I wonder, don't they have to play that game? I mean, if they get to choose between couture gowns and get dripped in jewels, don't they have to name where they got them?
I don't know if they have to. I mean, I think that's a good question. I don't feel like the two things need to be mutually exclusive. If they want to share what they're wearing, great, but let's also get at some meaty questions that are actually, you know, interesting about this.
Well, I've actually read that those who are not playing the game, you know, Cate Blanchett apparently pointed to a cameraman who was giving the swoop, you know, up from the bottom of her gown to her face. You know, what did she say? Something like,
she said, do you do this to the guys? And, you know, Elle magazine has also begun asking men on the red carpet, what are you wearing? Mm-hmm. How do you manage your private and personal life balance? And, you know, I've done that too. And it's fun to turn that around a bit, but, you know, that might be sort of delicately dancing around deeper issues.
Well, and also I read in The Guardian there was a commentator who said to Cate Blanchett, you know, don't bite the hand that feeds you. We enjoy this. You get to wear these beautiful gowns. How do we, as the viewers, eating this stuff up, play into this game?
I mean, we're part of the feeding frenzy for sure. And when you hear a funny comment about a dress, it just feels, it's so delightfully bitchy. I don't know if I can say that word. You know, there is a delight in that. But I think really it is at what cost? You know, can we take pot shots, but also what is that saying about our culture? I mean, I don't know what the answer is to that. I just think that it is interesting that there is a pushback against this at this point in time.
So what do you think, Kara Buckley? Have we reached, as Hadley Freeman of The Guardian put it, peak red carpet?
I think we'll find out at the Oscars. You know, a colleague of mine in the fashion section, Alexandra Jacobs, wrote that the E! Entertainment host, Juliana, seemed like almost like Diane Sawyer on the Grammys red carpet, and she was wondering if the tide is beginning to shift. We'll find out on Oscar night. To be honest, I would be surprised if it would have shifted, you know, that much, but maybe, you know, maybe we'll see some more substantive questions and answers coming out of the red carpet.
Well, Kara Buckley, thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure.
Kara Buckley is a culture reporter for the New York Times. There's a link to read her article on the red carpet, A Revolt Builds Over Pageantry. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we can blame the comedian Joan Rivers for popularizing the "who are you wearing" trope. Beginning in 1996, the edgy comic revived her sagging career by skewering the fashion pageant of A-listers as host of The Red Carpet on E!. And from 2010 to 2014, Rivers hosted E!'s Fashion Police with her daughter Melissa. From Johnny Depp to Nicole Kidman, Joan was an equal opportunity insult machine. Here's just a sampling of her red carpet observations.
She looked like she was dressed by Martha Stewart's towel department. She looks like she went to Macy's and got gift wrapped. She has got that alabaster skin, and rumor had it she had spent hours covered with leeches to get that pale.
Really?
Yeah.
Are we at SeaWorld or the Oscars?
He looks like a homeless man that walked in by mistake.
One of my biggest disappointments of the night.
All I can say is that unlike her character in Juno, in that dress, believe me, she ain't gonna score tonight.
Nicole Kidman, she was in a Balenciaga dress.
And I think she was having a good time. You know, you can't tell with her because she's got all that Botox. And
yeah.
You look at her and you're just not sure. What's happening? I understand, though, she's hired a young Guatemalan woman now to smile for her.
Oh, that's an accessory.
Yeah.
That was, of course, the scathingly witty Joan Rivers. And the awards extravaganza continues on Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to approach the Oscar snub from a different angle. Instead of focusing on films and actors who got the cold shoulder, this year we have come up with entire categories notably absent from the awards. We reveal the winners of this year's WAMIs when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each year, critics and moviegoers make a show of combing through the list of Academy Award nominees to determine who got snubbed. That's all well and good and often quite entertaining. But we at Word of Mouth have been thinking for some time now that there are entire categories that get the cold shoulder from the Oscars. And it's about time we talked about them. So we asked Amy Diaz, movie reviewer and editor of The Hippo, to join us for what we are calling the WAMIs, an unauthorized celebration of achievements that go uncelebrated at the Oscars. And Amy, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks. I feel like I should ask you who you're wearing.
I'm wearing my pajamas. I'm so glad you were game for this. It's such a fun exercise. And you were kind enough to come up with a fantastic list of categories and nominees for the WAMIs. So let's start with the award for Best Voice Acting. First of all, why does this deserve to be part of the Oscars?
Well, you know, why not? Honestly, there have been years recently where I felt like the pool of best animated films have been stronger than the pool of best films. So, you know, we recognize the actors in the best films. Why not recognize the people in the animated films? It's a slightly different kind of acting, too. You know, mm-hmm. what they're bringing to the movie, what they're bringing to the part. So I think it's worth some recognition.
So let's hear some of the nominees for Best Voice Acting.
So I had, this category is Lego Movie and Guardians of the Galaxy heavy, I'll admit. So from the Lego Movie, Chris Pratt, Will Ferrell, and Morgan Freeman. From Guardians of the Galaxy, Bradley Cooper and Vin Diesel. And then from Box Trolls, which I think is actually nominated, Elle Fanning, who played this great little girl character that was kind of a classic storybook little girl. She's, you know, adventurous but bossy and kind of ghoulish. And I loved the character.
Well, I like that you brought up the Lego Movie, which, of course, notably did get snubbed. Let's hear a clip.
Relax, everybody. I'm here.
Batman!
What's up, babe?
Babe!
What?
Oh, sorry, Batman. This is Emmett. Emmett, this is my boyfriend, Batman.
I'm Batman.
That's your boyfriend?
Hey, babe.
What?
Let's hold hands.
Chris Pratt, Elizabeth Banks, and Will Arnett's voices there from the Lego Movie. Do you think that this category should also include CGI motion capture performances?
You know, I think that maybe deserves to be its own thing. And it could be one of those things where they do it in the years where they have it, or they could just give it to Andy Serkis every single year, and that would also work. You know, he did a great job this year in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And that was almost not even voice acting, because there wasn't a whole lot of voice in what he was doing for that role. You know, there was a little bit. So I think it definitely, it's another kind of acting. It's a thing we're going to see in movies a lot. You know, we saw it in several movies this year. So I think, why not kind of give them some praise? You know, I was listening to Fresh Air recently and heard Benedict Cumberbatch talk about what he did to play Smaug the dragon in the Hobbit movies. There's a lot that goes into it.
Well, I was also thinking of last year, Scarlett Johansson in the film Her. You know, she was this disembodied computer voice. Did a fantastic job.
She did. And you know, those are, again, they're really important performances to the movies, but they're maybe they don't fit in the traditional, you know, actor, supporting actor kind of sections.
All right. So the next big category that you're suggesting an Oscar should be awarded for is casting. Why casting?
Well, you know, casting, or you could call it ensemble or best cast. Just, you know, when a movie gets a group of people, not just one great actor and everybody else, but, you know, a group of people who all kind of bring a little something to it, it's really magical. And, you know, there were definitely some movies this year that were great because of each of the characters, not just one great performance, but everyone brought a little something that made it the movie it was.
Okay, so what are your nominees for best casting in a motion picture?
So my picks would be Whiplash, Guardians of the Galaxy again, the Lego Movie again, The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1, which to me is all cast. That's
yeah.
What makes that movie what it is.
Julianne Moore, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I
Woody
actually
Harrelson.
Scratched my head wondering what they were doing in that film.
You know, and here's the thing. While I was watching it, I realized I don't actually care about the main plot or the love triangle, very tepid love triangle between Jennifer Lawrence and her two male love interests. I just was delighted to watch Woody Harrelson, Natalie Dormer, all these really strong actors
Stanley Tucci.
Stanley Tucci. And then my other pick, and I think this is the quintessential one for this year, was Gone Girl. This one I thought was one where every person in this movie did a really fantastic job and brought a little something. You're never probably going to hear me say this. This is the first time I've certainly ever said this, but Tyler Perry should have been nominated for an award.
He played this kind of like money-grubbing lawyer, or let's say aggressive, famous lawyer. He was terrific.
And brought like this note of very sharp humor and was completely unexpected and was fantastic. Ben Affleck, I thought, was great because the movie kind of used not just his strengths as an actor, but all of his weaknesses to help create this character. I would totally sign up for the TV show that is just Kim Dickens and Patrick Fugit, who played the detectives investigating the crime. I would watch the show where they just investigate stuff. That was great. They were fantastic.
You don't know if she has friends. You don't know what she does all day. And you don't know your wife's blood type.
Sure, y'all are married. I maybe it's typo.
Where are her folks? New York?
Yeah.
Can they get here in time for this press conference tomorrow?
Tomorrow? I have no idea. I haven't talked to them.
You haven't called your wife's parents
yet? I mean, you can't get a signal in this building. I've been in here talking to you.
Well, call them, please, Nick, now.
Fine. Should I know my wife's blood type?
Okay, so that is Gone Girl, one of Amy's nominees for Best Casting in a Motion Picture in the WAMIs, our new awards. Okay, so Guardians of the Galaxy comes up again. Lego Movie comes up again. We actually spoke to Oscar-nominated actor John C. Reilly last week. He had a bit role in Guardians of the Galaxy. And since we had him on the phone, asked him if he thought there were any categories missing from the Oscars.
This age-old thing that, you know, I actually sang about in the Oscars with Will Ferrell and Jack Black, this idea that comedy somehow should be acknowledged in some way. But, yeah, I honestly don't spend too much time thinking about awards. But I'd rather think about actually doing work. But if I was the king of the Oscars, I would say absolutely a voiceover award, a cast award, and some type of acknowledgement of the comedy world.
Actor John C. Reilly there advocating for several new categories at the Oscars, and he apparently thinks very much like my guest, Amy Diaz. She is the movie reviewer and editor of The Hippo, and we're celebrating achievements that should be in the Oscars but are not. So, Amy, he brought up this age-old comedies at the Oscars problem. What do you think there?
Well, you know, and I would, first of all, I would love to watch the Oscars where he was king of the Oscars. That would be great. because he's totally right. Comedy gets no respect at all. And a successful comedy, especially if it's a successful comedy that kind of hits on different levels, you know, it's lots of people find it funny, but it also has these smart moments. That is so much harder than, you know, the dramatic story that's maybe just a biopic about someone important and you put some swelling music behind it. Some of those are really good, too. But comedy is so hard, and that it gets so little respect is unfortunate, because those are oftentimes the movies that we love.
Well, the next category for the WAMIs is Best On-Screen Duo. Now, is this a romantic pairing or any pair of performers eligible?
I think it could be any pair of performers. And, you know, I didn't include this on my list, but another great example is a Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum from 22 Jump Street. The energy of those two guys together. I mean, that was the perfect pairing. You make that movie with any two other people, I don't know that it's as fun or as silly or as kind of meta and smart as it is with those guys. They just do such a good job and have so much chemistry. So
who are your other nominees for Best Duo?
You know, I think Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike, which I guess they would be romantic for some of that movie, and then for some of that movie, highly antagonistic, and yet they still have a great chemistry, and the kind of what they're doing works together really well. Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, who really just, for Edge of Tomorrow, which the last time I was here, I told everyone to run out and see it. Go see it again if you saw it then. It's just so much fun. And they have a really great relationship that characters do that kind of just skirts the edge of romance but doesn't completely go there. So mostly you're watching this really tough girl and this kind of wimpy guy who kind of reluctantly is made a hero. And it's a great pairing that you wouldn't expect. Oh, and then Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman in The Railway Man. And I have to admit, what I loved about them is they're age appropriate. They are two people of roughly the same age, kind of the same age as the characters they play, and they look great together. They're like normal middle-aged people. Well, you know, normal middle-aged movie star people.
Yeah, they're pretty good-looking normal people.
But still, for Hollywood, that's as good as it gets. It's, you know.
Let's hear just a clip from The Railway Man. This is Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman. The film is not at all represented at the Oscars this year. Never mind, in the duo category.
So, I'm going to go up as far as Malaig by train, and then I'm catching the coach to Inverness and coming down the other side. What do you think?
The West Coast is extraordinarily beautiful. You might well fall in love with it.
And if I were to fall in love, what then?
Well, instead of a coach to Inverness, you might consider taking the line back to Tindrum and changing for Oban. And from there, you can get any number of boat trips. Iona, Staffa. It's very romantic. You romantic?
Oh, sounds romantic to me. Now, Amy, I'm wondering, do you not think that on-screen duo would kind of, I don't know, make the Oscars a little bit more like the MTV Movie Awards? I mean, borderline cheesy.
Sure. Absolutely. And yet, you know, it is one of those things you see, especially in romantic comedies, you can see it go wrong. So many times. It is not an easy thing to get right, to get two people who can have good chemistry, whether you're talking about romantically as like buddies, even as, you know, kind of villain and hero, you know, Whiplash. I would say that Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons, great duo, the way those two characters kind of play off of each other. Any other pair of actors, I don't know that they would have brought the same heat to that.
I'm thinking Ethan Hawke and L.R. Coltrane in Boyhood. I mean, there are scenes together.
Absolutely.
As father and son that were just terrific. And we were also discussing back at the WAM pod, Ray Fiennes and Zero, the character of Zero in Grand Budapest Hotel. They were
Yes. Sort
of accomplices.
Again, two characters, like just the way they interact brings something else to the movie.
Okay, so on to our next category, Best First Film. So what, Rookie Award?
Yeah, you know, kind of. I think that there is something to be said for praising people kind of right there at the beginning of their career. You know, somebody, one of the people that gives out awards does it as breakthrough. So you could kind of do it as not maybe the very first film. I tried to pick people where this was their first feature film. But if you maybe pick it as their first big film, then you could get someone like an Ava DuVernay, who I think Selma is her third feature film.
But
really her first breakthrough
as a director.
One. Exactly. And so, you know, my picks were Obvious Child, Gillian Robespierre. I think this was her first big feature. Dear White People, very smart, from writer-director Justin Simeon. just a really smart and funny look at kind of identity politics and how a lot of people don't fit into identity politics. And that's actually just available on streaming. So finally, you know, kind of everyone can see
it. Oh, I'm dying to see that.
It was so smart and so kind of sweet, too. And then St. Vincent, which I've often said, you know, if it weren't for the prostitutes and the strippers, it could be a family film. A very sweet film with Bill Murray. You know, he plays a very curmudgeonly guy who starts taking care of a neighbor boy reluctantly, but he needs the money. And it's sort of sweet to watch their relationship develop. Again, another example of a great duo.
All right, let's go. I'm going to make dinner. You can do homework.
Oh, I already ate.
Stop mowing. You're mowing dirt. Let's go.
He's fed. The homework's checked. I've done my job. I'm taking a break.
Why is he mowing your dirt patch?
Oh, yeah, he's paying me hourly.
I'm showing him how the world works. You work, you get paid, you drink.
Are you drinking alcohol?
Here's one that I did not realize was not a category, and this is Best Soundtrack. I mean, don't we already have that?
Well, we have, so Best Original Song, which means it has to be a new song for that movie, which is why a lot of times you'll get musicals that have moved from the stage to the screen and they add a new song because that can be nominated, but not the songs that have been part of the musical for many years. And then there's a score. So, you know, the lovely music that swells when the king gives a speech or whatever. You know, those are categories, but there's no category that really praises the, you know, compiling of pre-existing music that sort of shines a light on when that is done really well. A really classic example is T-Bone Burnett, who put together the soundtrack for Where, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that
and
was...
And so many others. He's a great, great compiler.
Absolutely, and has a reputation for being able to really pull together a great mix of songs that helps to tell the story and becomes a part of the movie. You couldn't imagine that movie without those songs. They're so interlaced.
Mm-hmm. So how about for this year?
For this year, I was thinking Book of Life, which is a great little animated movie and kind of brings a Mexican folk music twist to, you know, things like there was a song by Mumford and Sons, the song Creep. Boyhood, which did a really great job of matching songs to an era.
Yeah.
And you could almost figure out, remember when it was based on the song that was playing. I think it starts out with a Coldplay song from like the late 90s, early aughts.
And I remember the character, the little girl singing Britney Spears.
Exactly. And it so perfectly places it. That's when that was. Begin Again, and actually one of the songs from that movie is nominated because it was a brand new song, but music plays such a huge part throughout that movie. And then Chef, which was the Jon Favreau movie. And that movie does a great thing where it kind of gives you music connected to each of the cities where you're also seeing the food.
Mm-hmm.
So as they're making these very mouthwatering Cubanos in Miami, they're also listening to Cuban music. When they were in Louisiana, there was this great scene that had sort of a second line band version of Sexual Healing. Mm-hmm. It was just such a smart use of music. Again, you couldn't almost think of that movie without the way that they use the music.
No, and you're also talking to a big sort of cross-cultural mix there. And that's one thing it sounds like the Wammies have going for them. They are not quite as white as the Oscars.
Yay, Wammies!
Well, let's hear it for the Wammies and for Amy Diaz for playing the game. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And now the moment you've all been waiting for has finally arrived. It is time to give out the Wammies. The nominees for Best Voice Acting: Bradley Cooper as Rockets in Guardians of the Galaxy, Vin Diesel as Groot in Guardians of the Galaxy, Elle Fanning as Winnie in The Box Trolls, Will Ferrell as Lord Business and President Business in The Lego Movie, Morgan Freeman as Vitruvius in The Lego Movie, and Chris Pratt as Emmett Brickowski in The Lego Movie. And the Wammy for Best Voice Acting goes to Chris Pratt as Emmett Brickowski in The Lego Movie.
Good morning, apartment. Good morning, doorway. Morning, wall. Morning, ceiling. Good morning, floor.
Chris Pratt was unfortunately unable to make it to the NHPR studios to accept his award, so I will happily accept it on his behalf. And the nominees for the Andy Serkis Award for Best CGI Acting: Andy Serkis himself as Caesar in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and Benedict Cumberbatch as Smaug in The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. And the Wammy goes to Benedict Cumberbatch as Smaug in The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
I am fire!
I am dead.
Oh, I can't believe it. Benedict Cumberbatch was also unable to make it to the NHPR studios. So I will accept it on his behalf. Okay, nominees for Best Casting are Whiplash, Guardians of the Galaxy, Gone Girl, The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1, and The Lego Movie. And the WAMI goes to... Oh, and the WAMI goes to... It's a tie! The casts of The Hunger Games and The Lego Movie.
I just wanted to save my sister and keep Peeta alive.
Miss Everdeen, it's the things we love most that destroy us.
Introducing the double-decker couch, so everyone could watch TV together and be buddies.
That is literally the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Let me handle this. That idea is just the worst.
And I can't believe it, but representatives from both of these movies were unfortunately unable to make it here to accept their awards. So I will again accept it on their behalf. And the nominees for the best first film are Gillian Robespierre for Obvious Child, Justin Simien for Dear White People, and Tad Melfi for St. Vincent. And the WAMI for the best first film goes to... Ted Melfi for St. Vincent.
You need to defend yourself or you get mowed down.
Get out.
I'm small, if you haven't noticed.
And so is Hitler.
That's a horrible comparison.
Ted, thank you so much for being here. Do you have a speech prepared? No? Well, here's your award. Our heartfelt congratulations to Amy Diaz for helping us come up with the nominees, and to all the winners, and a special thank you to all of you, the members of the WAMI board, for voting. You can see the full list of winners at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And a special thanks today to Fiona Shea, who is leaving us as an intern from NHPR's Word of Mouth. Best of luck, Fiona. We look forward to seeing your name in lights in the future. And we'll see you next year on the WAMI's red carpet. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Cheryl Glickman is a single 40-something-year-old woman living in L.A. She works for a company that makes self-defense exercise videos. She's got a psychosomatic lump in her throat that sometimes prevents her from swallowing and has a nearly obsessive crush on a 60-year-old man who's lusting after a teenaged girl. Cheryl, or more accurately, Cheryl's ever-chattering brain, narrates The First Bad Man, the debut novel of the artist and writer and filmmaker Miranda July. Maybe you first heard that name when her quirky and charming 2005 film Me and You and Everyone We Know won the special jury prize at Sundance. Since then, she's made a second film, she's written a book of short stories and created a messaging app and has performed all over the world. The First Bad Man continues July's skill at revealing uncomfortable moments and unexpected truths. And Miranda July, it's a real pleasure to have you with us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So this character, Cheryl Glickman, she is archly funny, I thought anyway. Maybe not on purpose, we imagine, because she's rigidly controlled. Can you tell us about her carefully constructed system, as she calls it, for living alone?
Right. Her system is... like the way that she keeps house. And yeah, she lives alone. And I think we all kind of do this, especially when we live alone. Like, you just come up with the most efficient way to do things. So, for example, she doesn't use a bowl or a plate. She just eats right out of the pan to save that amount of dishwashing. And she only has one set of dishes, so they can't accumulate, you know. And there's this thing called carpooling, which is if you're going to move an object to put it, you know, back where it goes in the house, you wait until there's a number of objects that need to go in the same direction, and then you carry them all together. Things like that, which are, I should say, like, which sounds so crazy when you isolate them and write them down. But I think people do this kind of thing without thinking.
And it is constantly going on inside of her head, so we know what it is. She's got this inner dialogue that sometimes borders on the delusional, I think. Was indulging in that a fun exercise for you? What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was a joy to write Cheryl. She's sort of like my shadow self that I furiously work to, like, outrun, you know? Like, I have to work very hard all the time every day not to be her.
So she's unfiltered you?
Well, no, she's me if I didn't like make things all the time. Hmm. I mean, I'm making things all the time so that I won't end up being completely inert and alone like her.
Well, you do. You've manifested so much in your life. You know, I'm thinking of this quote from True Detective. I mean, you know, did you watch it, by the way?
I've watched one.
Okay, so the Matthew McConaughey character, he says, life's barely long enough to get good at one thing. And here you are, you write, you've made films, you do performance art, and you make it look kind of easy. Does it just look that way?
Yeah, no, it's as hard as doing just one of those things, which is plenty hard. I mean, I think I myself, if I was listening to the radio and I heard that description, I'd be like, oh, that person isn't taking any of those things seriously, you know, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to take that person seriously. I mean, that's actually how I feel when I hear that. But all I can say is I just started out that way. Like, I've never not done this. When my first movie was, you know, kind of a bit of a hit, I was encouraged, like, okay, now just do movies. And it was like, well, but what about all these other things that have been sustaining me, you know, and on all these different levels? Like, I really should just drop all of them because this is the thing, you know, that other people care about or that I could make money on. So it's something I do for myself first and foremost.
I think it's inspired a lot of jealousy, a lot of venom from people. I was reading on the back of your book, there's a blurb by Lena Dunham. And when I was doing research for this interview, I was actually shocked to learn how much you have in common with her in terms of haters. You know, you've inspired a lot of anti-fans. Do you think they have a problem with your work, or is it your ability to just do it all and succeed?
Yeah, at this point, I feel like I don't like that story. The story of haters is almost. It's not that it's not true, but it's almost like media generated. Like, I think what Lena and I both experience is our extreme luck to be doing exactly what we want to do with a massive amount of supporters. And yeah, I'd say that neither of us is fitting into the exact way a woman is supposed to be. Like, if you're not perfect, and neither she nor I are perfect or perfectly sexy, then you're supposed to be a little bit apologetic about yourself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're annoying.
I was actually wondering if it was female focused.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Cheryl, because she's the female who is the focus of your book. In this novel, there's a lot of fetishism. There's this blurred lines between sex and violence, but in a very literary novel kind of way, very different from, let's say, 50 Shades of Grey, okay?
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the role that sexuality plays in this book and what you were exploring?
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because this character is actually almost asexual. I mean, she's in her 40s. She's pear-shaped. She's not beautiful. And I guess my way into her was into her sexual fantasies, which I got kind of fascinated by the fact that we do all these things in our sexual fantasies that don't reflect who we are on the outside or who we even want to be. I mean, I think that straight people have gay fantasies. I think that women, without even being aware of it, are often the man in a sexual fantasy, simply because you're thinking about the object of desire, which, whether it's you, you know, or another woman, you're thinking about how nice it feels for the man, you know, which is kind of the way that sex is sold to us. Like, the man is the one kind of having the most fun. And so in talking to friends very carefully and respectfully about this, and thinking about my own inner world, I realized, like, oh, I can have a character completely go off the hook without she herself needing to be freaky or radical in any way. I mean, she's quite a conservative woman, because that is actually how we are.
I'm speaking with the artist and filmmaker and author Miranda July. Her debut novel, The First Bad Man, is now out. It is a wickedly funny book that takes on fetishism, neuroses, motherhood, to the kind of inner dialogue that is running frequently inside of our heads. Well, there is a bit of a spoiler here, but through a weird chain of circumstances, Cheryl actually plays mother to a newborn in a certain point in this book. And there's this passage on page 220 that really struck me, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read it for us.
Right, sure. But as the sun rose, I crested the mountain of my self-pity and remembered I was always going to die at the end of this life anyway. What did it really matter if I spent it like this, caring for this boy, as opposed to some other way? I would always be earthbound. He hadn't robbed me of my ability to fly or live forever. I appreciated nuns now, not the conscripted kind, but modern women who chose it. If you were wise enough to know that this life would consist mostly of letting go of things you wanted, then why not get good at the letting go rather than the trying to have? These exotic revelations bubbled up involuntarily, and I began to understand that the sleeplessness and vigilance and constant feedings were a form of brainwashing, a process by which my old self was being molded, slowly but with a steady force, into a new shape, a mother. It hurt. I tried to be conscious while it happened, like watching my own surgery. I hoped to retain a tiny corner of the old me, just enough to warn other women with. But I knew this was unlikely.
Miranda July there, reading from her novel, The First Bad Man. I loved that passage because it seemed so authentic to the experience of a recent mother, you know, this sleep-deprived, all-consuming state of early parenting. And I read that you actually handed this book into the publisher just before giving birth yourself. Is that true?
Oh, well, better than that. I handed in the first draft, so I had just gotten started. So I did, in fact, write, you know, did all my rewriting and most of the writing of the book in the first 2 years of my son's life.
Okay, so, well, that makes more sense to me because I wondered how you came up with the words that rang so true.
No, I waited. In fact, I wrote a little note to my editor in that first draft. I was like, I'm not even going to bother filling out the baby sections because next week I'll be a mom and I'll know, you know. It's funny. There was a lot more of myself that I thought was going to end up in the book in terms of being a mother. And it was a process of crossing things out because it's like you come out of this fever dream and you realize, oh, wait, I'm telling a fiction here. Hmm. And there are other stories besides my baby story.
Well, I know that in the book, Cheryl works at the pseudo-spiritual martial arts studio turned exercise video outfit. It is very new agey. And meanwhile, I read that you grew up in Vermont where your parents had a publishing company that focused on spirituality and alternative health and martial arts. In the book, the parent characters are full of psychobabble. I'm wondering if there are autobiographical connections there in The First Bad Man.
Yes, for sure. And I think the thing is, if you grow up in that, that's what you have to work with, and you have a pretty deep, complex relationship to it. So, you know, one person might read it as just straight satire, whereas for me, it's like, well, I know that these are real people. Yeah, I can see the humor in it, but I also wouldn't just make fun of it. And I think there is that, it kind of, the book walks that line. Like, you're never sure, like, am I supposed to be believing in this? Mm. And that's kind of how I felt growing up. Like, I'm not ruling out anything. Like, color therapy might be real. I'm very open, but I'm also not going to be completely sold on anything because, you know, I've met so many people who are like, you know, color therapy is their life. And you know, I don't want to be that person either because there's a sort of blindness there. So I'm never quite sure exactly how it reads to the wider world, but it's what I have to work with. And each time I try and move very far away from it, you know, I find my way back.
Well, for this reader, reading about Cheryl taking the essence of red was pretty funny, I have to say. And Miranda, yeah, you starred in both of the feature films that you've made so far. I'm wondering if this book were turned into a movie, would you play Cheryl?
Oh, well, I'm not yet pear-shaped. I don't know if you were saying I was.
No, not at all.
I mean, I think...
You could wear prosthetics. That's always good for, you know, getting a lot of good accolades.
Yeah, I don't know if you get an Oscar just for, like, a big butt. I think if they, like, age you.
It's got to be a nose or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually very consciously tried to make a story that didn't have a character that I could play because I feel like that's something I get to do in fiction. And when I'm making a movie thus far, I've always felt like I need to be in it. And therefore, I have to have a character that's pretty much like me because I'm not like a fantastically talented actress. I mean, I can do it, but I don't want to try out being like a working class British woman. Like, I think I'll, you know, stay close to home. So I thought of these characters as looking unlike me. But yes, you're right. I would play Cheryl sooner than I'd play Klee.
I think there are so many good options for Klee.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
But so you have written this novel, a book of short stories. You've made two films. You've created this app. What's next for you?
Oh, I need to buckle down and start writing my next script. Hmm. Filmmaking is one of those things, like, I don't want to lose it. Like, it's such a lucky thing to be able to do. It's so hard, but so worth it. So in between all these interviews and stuff, I write down little ideas, and I know that when I have some quiet time again, that I will just be writing this script.
Oh, I guess we won't be expecting the working class British woman in that script, but I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Miranda Dely, she's an artist, she's a writer, a filmmaker, and I think pretty much whatever else she decides she wants to be. And you can find out more about her new novel, which is called The First Bad Man, and read some of the terrific reviews. There are links at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, if you're living on the Eastern Seaboard, or especially the Boston area, this winter has been one for the record books. And while snowfall in New Hampshire hasn't quite reached record levels, we have had our fair share. While New Englanders continue to dig out from storms Juno and Neptune, the mounds of snow remind us of storms past. Sean Hurley brings us the story.
The snow falls. The storm ends and starts again. I plant my shovel in the snow pile, like a flag on the moon of winter. Take my boots off, put them back on again. The plows shudder by and shudder by, on snow-chained tires and spitting sand. And I have no plans to lean the shovel in its summer spot behind the house. I remember shoveling the family driveway in the blizzard of 78. I was 11 years old and new. I was shoveling legendary snow. In fourth grade, we had to learn to spell the word Samaritan. The teacher told us what a good Samaritan was, and I wondered about the existence of such a peculiar and helpful person. Was I a good Samaritan? Early one morning in the snow, I was 10, I went down the street and shoveled the walkways of my older neighbors. Good Samaritan. That great pair of two good words ran in circles around my head, like a halo in the making. But this was also the counter magic to a summertime habit I regularly indulged. The bad Samaritan game of Ding Dong Ditch. I hoped as I shoveled that someone would catch me being so good. They would smile from a window or come down and try to give me something. I would accept an English muffin or hot chocolate, but I would refuse all offers of money. I would brush off any thanks, disappear as quickly as possible, late for my next appointment with utter goodness. But no one noticed, and later I waited to hear the powerful rumors of the mysterious shoveler. But there was nothing. Apparently, good Samaritans can go unseen, unspoken of. It must be too late, but I still want to tell them it was me, you fools, who shoveled your walk in the late 70s. And also, by the way, it was me ringing your doorbell. All those times there was no one there, I'm sorry about that. And yes, I'll take an English muffin. I've always shoveled where I've lived, but when we moved to Thornton a decade ago, there was already a neighbor long used to plowing out our horseshoe driveway, so I let it go. But we had our walkway, 4 feet wide by 10 feet long, and I had my Samaritan's history with walkways. I make a big deal of what I've got left, the shoveler's equivalent of a comb-over, a postage stamp I can clear in a single minute, but I am still a shoveler, a veteran of the Great Blizzard of 78, unrecognized walkway Samaritan of the year before. The plows shudder by and shudder by. I plant my shovel in the snow pile, like a flag on the moon of winter. Boots off and on. The storm ends and starts again. And I have no plans to lean the shovel in its summer spot behind the house. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe. That's at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please write a review and tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.